All right, it's December 13th. This is Congress Two Beers In. My name is Josh Huter. I'm a senior fellow at the Government Affairs Institute at Georgetown University. I'm with my colleagues Laura Blessing and Matt Glassman.
How y'all doing?
And we are on our second Sweetwater 420 Extra Pale Ale. It is delicious. It's the closest thing that I could find to Alabama.
Yeah, it's not from Alabama.
It's not from
Which is
Alabama.
What we were intended to do today, but we didn't do. Thanks.
I don't know that Alabama makes beer, which is going to be offensive to people that make beer in Alabama, but...
Okay.
Does anybody know of a beer? Somebody, like one of the dozens of listeners, needs to tell us if there's a beer from Alabama.
Yeah.
And we'll have it one time.
Yeah.
Like after they elect another Democrat.
Right.
Which may be several,
never. So
several
never,
decades
never.
From now.
Not 2021,
so,
for sure.
So this is the
all
big
beer
story.
Commentary is not for us.
That's right. So last night, Doug Jones wins 49.9 to Roy Moore's 48.4 in a state that has not elected a Democrat in over two decades. So what happened? Like what?
Well, yeah. and their Democrats tend to turn into Republicans, you know?
Yeah,
I
right.
mean, that's
right.
the past history.
Which is the case of the senior senator from Alabama, Richard Shelby,
right.
who was first elected to the Senate as a Democrat
yeah.
and then switched to the Republican Party in 1994.
Played
that's right. I mean,
that's some good
time. I can certainly remember in high school when Hal Heflin was in the mm-hmm. seat in Alabama, and certainly he was a Democrat, and certainly he was the kind of Democrat you thought of as, oh, a Southern Democrat.
Right.
That
sort
kind.
Of like the Zell Millers.
Yeah, name. It was hard to picture a Democrat ever coming back to Alabama after that, but now we have one. Doug Jones will be in the United States Senate from whenever they seat him until January of
2021.
Yeah.
And then after that, in all likelihood, he will not be in the United States Senate, and there will be a Republican back in that seat.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think, you know, on the electoral side, I think that some component of this is reflective of national trends. You saw some enthusiasm
sure.
and mobilization from Dems. But for the most part, this is about Moore. This is about two things. One is Moore is extremely conservative on substantive issues. And second, you had the sexual misconduct allegations. And you know, Nate Silver wrote that he thought each of those was one-third component. And then the national component of the swing was the other one-third. And I think that's about as good as a guess as anyone can make, and that some component of this you're going to see reflected going forward electorally, but most of it you're not. You're not going to see 30-point swings
sure,
in party affiliation voting.
Very unusual candidate, but to be sure, Trump's endorsement did not help this guy as much as it would have helped an Alabama candidate a year ago.
Yeah.
You know, those ratings are newly underwater, which is a major electoral shift of note.
Right. What was it? What's his approval in Alabama right now? It's like 45-45. It's tied or something like that.
Who's approval?
Trump's.
He's
right?
a
and this is
48 underwater to 47 positive.
Right.
What I've seen,
right.
Yeah.
That's which is bonkers for
which
a state that he won with 70 some odd percent of the vote.
Sure.
Right?
Although it's also, you know, plus 15 or whatever against his national approval. So
right.
it's certainly
sure.
a state where he has strength.
Right.
You know, I think in terms of the Senate consequences of this, which I think is more in our wheelhouse anyway. The first thing is I don't think there are any immediate consequences. The Secretary of State doesn't have to certify, or in some places ever can't certify this for 2 weeks. At any rate, it's not going to be certified down there until the end of December. That doesn't mean the Senate can't seat
sure.
Jones early, but they certainly don't have to. They're not under any obligation if someone doesn't have a certificate of election, and they're not going to, according to McConnell.
Right.
This is someone who waited out Garland a year. You're not going to shame him into seating
right.
Doug Jones this week.
And while the you know, the Democrats are doing the doogie right now, and I believe Bannon's feeling unmoored, I do think that the real winner here is McConnell. I mean, he is going to lose a seat in the Senate, but this would have been an incredibly unruly senator to try to corral. You know, I'm not sure that, you know, I think he actually kind of dodged a bullet, and that's one of the things that people aren't talking about here. What do you think, Josh?
I mean, outside of that super pun point right there, I think you're exactly right. I mean, you hear from some Republican staffers and Republicans that know things around the Hill, and they think that this is actually a blessing in disguise in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
They think that the Moore being seated in the Republican Party was this beginning of the end of the Republican Party in the Senate, right? Because
yeah.
It divides the party. Do you seat him? Do you expel him? Do you do that? What do you do with this guy who
sure,
has credible...
Sure, and it's a constant black
right.
eye the whole time.
Exactly. Too. And I agreed completely with Matt. What does this mean? Well, it means essentially nothing, right? I was watching, I forget which network it was, but I was watching last night, And one of the like bylines that was running underneath, it says, as of this hour, Republicans control the Senate. And I was like, yeah, no, that's totally true. And it'll be true tomorrow and the next day and the next week, next month. And it's essentially, it nicely sums up the state of play. They lose a seat. What do they actually lose by losing a seat? Like, mostly nothing, right? They want to wrap up the tax bill before Jones would be seated. They're going to be spending bills, which are going to have to pass bipartisan compromise later on, right? You're going to need to ease the BCA caps with 60 votes. You're going to need to pass appropriations bills with 60 votes. All of this stuff is going to be totally and utterly meaningless when it comes down to the stuff that's going to happen within the next month or two.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think for the purposes of the 115th Congress, this is more a blessing in disguise for McConnell. Obviously, this is going to have implications for 2018 elections and the 116th sure. Congress, which, you know, are longer term things. But in the short term, I agree generally that this makes McConnell's life a little bit easier. I do think there are two sets of implications that are potentially dangerous coming out of this. One is if it really amps up the leverage that the swing Republicans bring to bear on this. There is a big difference between having a two-vote cushion and a one-vote cushion to use when you're trying to package legislation together. When there's multiple people who could be holdouts, they can get into a race to the bottom, and you can buy them off. Who's going to buy off the cheapest? Now you have one less person. Now it's only two people who have to really grind in against anything you're doing.
I think that's an excellent point. I think they were always planning on rushing through the tax bill, so that was going to be done anyway. And after that, you know, what are the major pieces of legislation that are, you know, on deck? I don't know of any. Yeah. And they're also about to go into a major, you know, into what they will see as a major election.
Right.
I'm not sure that there's, I do think that there's more leverage for individual senators, but A, they haven't made as good use of that potential leverage thus far. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about the tax bill in a second. Mm-hmm. But, you know, B, there isn't a major legislative push that's kind of waiting in the wings here.
Yeah. I mean, I think the other side of it is, one is the center's leverage. Second is if this spooks vulnerable 2018 Republicans in the House or Senate, and they start altering their behavior in the 115th Congress because this is scaring them for what's coming next November.
Here's the thing about that. I mean, what are they going to start being spooked about, though? I mean, well, like, so the things that have been so... I don't know that we even want to get in this right now, but there's the spending package that's coming up, right? Okay. So here's the most immediate thing, other than the tax bill, which we're going to get to a second, right? The spending's coming up, and the spending has all sorts of stuff that's attached to it, right? We're talking border wall. There's still discussion of infrastructure. Right. I don't know why, right? There's still talk of immigration reform.
There's CHIP.
There's CHIP. Sure. The CSR payments. All of this stuff is going to get packaged into this giant spending package. I don't see how this fundamentally changes because
I think it's going to be difficult to observe, but you know, when you're looking at who has leverage in these negotiations, is it going to make it more likely that Republicans in the House who are moderates cave quicker and really get vociferously about not shutting the government down, for instance, or not doing Marie Alexander, right, or not doing CHIP, or holding out? And I don't think there's anything you're going to be able to easily tease out and see. But it could be the case that this gives the Democrats even more leverage than they already have over the spending bill, which I think is already high to begin with.
Right. And what about the debt ceiling, right? Yeah. Let's not forget that that's around the corner, too.
Right.
It would also be interesting to see what kind of a role that Doug Jones, you know, is going to style for himself, particularly since it's unlikely that he'll be reelected. Yep. I mean, will he be someone who tries to create a block of moderates? Will he be someone who wants to highlight, you know, the benefits of the Democratic Party for a state like his? You know, he has potentially a very interesting platform, so I'm excited to see what he's going to do with it.
I kind of hope we see like a rogue Doug Jones, right? Just like, woo, we're here for 2 years.
I mean, I think
let's get weird, right?
Doug Jones, you're invited on our podcast anytime you want.
We'll have you here whenever you want. You need a time.
That's right. And bring a beer from Alabama.
Yeah, and we will delete the beginning of this podcast. I think Laura is exactly correct on that, and that what path Jones is going to carve out in the Senate is totally up in the air. I could see him hewing to a Manchin-like conservative Democrat, maybe even more so, is one possibility. The other possibility is that he looks at this as a situation where he's not going to win, and he skews kind of his own line, whatever that may be, that he personally believes in. You know, this isn't someone who has a long list of electoral history that we can go by. We do know that he was active as kind of a civil rights crusader, prosecuting the 16th Street bombing suspects and that he is pro-choice. So these things are already out of step with Alabama. And the idea that all of a sudden he's going to mold himself to the state to try and win re-election, it seems kind of unlikely to me. How much he's going to hew that way or ignore that path, I don't know.
I'm interested to see if he's going to take on the economic populist message that's out there, right? Is he going to pick up like the Bernie Sanders like type talk where he goes out there and starts going like, when you talk about the people and all this other, but in like an Alabama accent, right? And he starts talking about all of these popular notes because, I mean, this is something that's really played well in Alabama from the president of the United States, right, is the sort of populist message. There's an opportunity for him to do that, to carve out that sort of unique economic niche there. I mean, it's not going to save his seat, right, but I am interested in whether or not he's going to pick that up and hope that he can get reelected, because I think it's his best shot. I don't know that he has one, but I think it's probably his best shot. And right, on things like that, where do you vote? I mean, you can vote either way, right? You can vote for a tax bill, and you can vote against bad spending packages with Democrats. Yeah. I mean, it's sort of, you can be all over the map and still carve out a nice spot for yourself.
I do think that I don't expect Doug Jones to start doing things where he crosses party lines on things like nominations.
Sure.
Judicial nominations or executive branch nominations. I think the gap is wide enough, and he's a Democrat enough that he is going to stick with the Democratic Party on those types of votes. I could be wrong, but I don't get the sense that Jones is going to all of a sudden be voting with Trump, for instance.
Well, and he didn't change who he was on certain issues that probably electorally hurt him during this race. I mean, the fact that he's a pro-choice Democrat, I'm convinced that he probably could have tacked another 10 points onto his victory if he had decided to be, you know, to forget about that position. Given the electorate.
That's a good point.
So
let's talk about the tax bill.
Let's talk about taxes. Yeah.
Laura, let it rip. I don't know who else is talking about taxes. Nobody else is talking about
taxes. Another pun, just in case you guys.
I'm sure tell me about the tax bill. Let it rip. Yeah.
Well, you know, here's the thing. Elections have consequences.
No.
Yes.
Oh. Not this one.
That's right. We just spent 15 minutes talking about how this last election means absolutely nothing to the Senate. Anyway.
National elections have consequences. And we have Republican unitary control of our federal government. Their major party building position is to cut taxes. And so we're seeing a very large tax cut. I mean, I think it's been interesting that these folks have been salivating at the opportunity to do tax reform and not just a tax cut for a very long time. I mean, this is something that I like to call the great white whale of American politics. It's very elusive. It tends to come around about once a generation. And while I think what we have is more of a tax cut than tax reform, you have a lot of different attempts to do a lot of different things to the tax bill. Now, of course, the big takeaway items is that this is something that's going to really help the wealthy, particularly wealthy corporations, and also because the ACA mandate is being repealed as well. You know, CBO is estimating that 13 million people are going to have health insurance as a consequence of this bill. So those are kind of like the big kind of top line effects of this, but it's fascinating in so many different ways to me. I mean, there are so many different things that have been on the Republican tax policy wish list for a long time that have made it into this bill, but it also interacts with things that we talk about at the office all the time, like the decline of regular order, how rushed this thing was. You know, you're now having tax lawyers publish like multiple pages of like, you know, 34, 36 pages of ways to game the current tax bill because this thing went through so quickly. Yeah. So there are so many different angles we can take on this thing.
Just to give context, Laura wrote her dissertation on Republican tax policy, essentially, at the University of Virginia. So she knows a little bit about this. We're going to defer most things substantive to her.
But from your point of view, this is a done deal as much as it can be, that the idea that this thing could fall apart post-conference now to you is a mirage?
I think it's highly unlikely. I realize that there are certain liberal voices in the conversation that are looking at a literal possibility and making it seem more likely than it is. Sure, you could still have different senators who oppose different aspects of the bill or wish it could be tweaked a little bit more, you know, put their foot down and say no, you know, like Susan Collins of the world. But there have been a lot of those people who supposedly had reservations but were brought back on board. I mean, this is a party building position that they have. They have a relatively short period of time to do what normally takes a good 2 years. You know, tax reform typically takes a very long time to produce. But I think they're going to push it through.
And you think a Christmas signing, Josh Lowe, you think a Christmas signing is a reasonable length of time to go here? The news reports say they want to move this through the Senate like Monday and through the House later that week. And so on that time schedule, you would have a signing, as President Trump says, for a Christmas present to the American people. Right. Do you see that as realistic?
Well, I mean, last time that we asked about tax policy, I said that there was no way that it was going to be done by the end of the year. And here we are, right? Yeah. We're a good solid, like, two legislative days away from putting this in action. So, you know, I think it's interesting because I think so much of the tax bill is also wrapped up in issues like other things that don't have to do with the tax bill, right? Yeah. The tax bill is getting rid of the individual mandate, right? And so Susan Collins has tied her support to this. Right. And so Susan Collins has tied her support to Alexander Murray, right? Which is a bill that is not possible in the House without Paul Ryan taking some significant heat. Senator Corker seems to be the only one that's like really, really hell-bent on like the deficit stuff.
Well, he's the only one who voted against it.
Right, and then we have Senator Flake, who said he was against it, but then was for it in the end. Because he got assurances that he'd be in the room when dreamers were discussed, I believe, was the terminology or something along those lines.
And I mean, we all want to be in the room where
I'm with Laura that this looks to me like a deal that's going to be done. Whether there's another twist to come, I don't know. It seems to me that Lee and Rubio should be quite upset right now, since they wanted to get their amendment in, and the reason they couldn't do it is because they would have to raise the corporate tax rate to do it. And now the corporate tax rate is being raised anyway.
They would have had to raise it to 22%. Right. The negotiations for this are still kind of coming out. They say that they've reached an agreement. We have yet to see the text of that agreement, so we're being mildly speculative here. But what's been announced so far is that the corporate rate is going to be at 21%. So they've given up this, you know, this amendment that would really help working families and would help, I think, the tax cut as a branding exercise for the Republican Party. Right. And they've raised that rate from 20% anyway.
I also think that was. I don't know if I would call it a failure, but that was a strategic choice by Schumer and the Democrats not to get behind that Lee Rubio amendment, because they could have provided the votes to make it darn close and probably to pass it. And they made a strategic choice that they just were going to let this go. That would have helped a lot of their voters. It would have helped a lot of low-income people. But instead, they're going to just say hands off and you can have this tax bill yourself, which is an absolutely reasonable political choice, but definitely a political choice. I don't know if it was a good or bad one on the merits, but that is what it is. I'm just saying there's a lot of Republicans who, in theory, would be skeptical of this, and a lot of Republicans who don't like this bill. Whether it gets three of them to no in the Senate, I don't see.
Sure. I mean, I think getting back to the Democratic strategic calculus, what's interesting to me here is that you can get Democrats, historically, to vote for tax cuts.
Yep.
And so, sure, Schumer made a strategic choice to not embrace Rubio Lee as an amendment, even though it would have pushed the needle in a way that I think that they would have been in favor of policy-wise. The Republicans have excluded the Democrats in to an unusual extent in the bargaining of this bill. So I think the water's been
to an unusual extent is like putting it mildly. Senate, this is like wow, right? This is pretty close. This is unprecedented in the Senate. I believe this level of exclusion.
If you look at major tax bills, as long as they don't lose unusually large amounts of money, and as long as there's something that's thrown in for the middle class, Democrats not only tend to vote for them, they tend to have most of their caucus voting for them.
Yeah. Interesting.
So, you know, Democrats are not, they're often very much willing to go along with the tax cut as long as the price tag isn't too big and something really explicitly gets given to the middle class, which, by the way, is not impossible.
Right. Well, so, I mean, this is something that's really interesting, right? Because it doesn't just speak to the policy of the issue. It speaks to the procedural dynamics and the partisan dynamics of this. Like, what's interesting about the Senate is that the way this process went through is not specifically senatorial, right? It's unusual. It looks weird, right? And that's because it looks looks like the House. Like, this is the way that they passed this thing, the way that McConnell funneled this thing through the Senate is almost the exact same way that Democrats in like 1910s were funneling things through their process onto the floor, right?
Did you probably have a chance to study this for your dissertation?
Okay. So basically, they came to an agreed upon bill behind closed doors in the caucus. They then tossed that entire bill onto the floor, and then they pass it without any amendment. Like, does that sound familiar? Yeah, it does. If you paid attention to the King caucuses back in the 1911, 1912, 1913, 14, 15, 16, all the way through 18 and under Wilson, this is the exact same process. This is a House process, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not at all surprising that the minority feels aggrieved by this process, just like they did back in the 1910s, because they are not a part of it.
Right? Well, I mean, you do have a Houseification of the Senate on many different fronts, yes. But it's also something where you have a pretty steep decline of regular order. And to be sure, this is something that both parties have done. However, yeah. Events over the past year have been an even more extreme version of a trend that was going in that direction. The idea that you wouldn't have substantive hearings on a lot of these things is right. Really kind of bananas, right. Especially for something like tax reform, which, again, tends to take about 2 years.
Right.
And, you know, Dave Camp, to his credit, when he put together...
Poor Dave Camp and Max Baucus.
I know. I'm sure they're
They work so hard. They went around the country.
They're like, psst, you know, your bill has all these technical problems. Just pick up mine and pass it.
So they probably are from there.
JCT for three goddamn years.
The House voted on HR1, the tax bill, on November 16th, and they got 227 votes, which surprised me because I thought there were enough New York, California, New Jersey Republicans who wanted to vote no, even if they wanted the bill to pass. They wanted to, for their own representational purposes, vote no, but they didn't. And now the bill is going to come back to the House. Will they get less votes? Is this the kind of thing that a lot of people are going to want to vote no and hope yes so they can squeak through? Is this going to be down in like the 220 range? Because, you know, you had Peter King and Lee Zeldin and Donovan and Staten Island and Faso and Stefanik and Chris Smith and Lobiondo and Rohrabacher and ISA. They all voted against it. But there's a whole set of California Republicans, Knight, Royce, Walters, who didn't vote against it, who voted for it the first time. Are they going to want to vote against it this time? Or is this just the ship has sailed and now they're tying themselves to this tax bill no matter how unpopular it is? Has things changed in the last month on this front?
That's a good question. It really depends on the state and local tax, right? Which is what under the Senate?
It's looking like they may get, you know, the ability to deduct up to $10,000 is what, I mean, again, they've reached an agreement. Right. We don't know the nitty-gritty of it.
So Peter King's never voting for that. He's got constituents who are paying triple that in property taxes.
Well, he has donors who are saying, psst.
Long Island.
Hey, bud.
Right. I mean, same thing with Rodney Frelinghuysen is going to have to vote for this thing. Tom MacArthur. I mean, it's going to be very, very interesting to see how they come down on this issue.
The significance of Frelinghuysen voting against it, Josh.
Right. Well, he's the appropriations chair, which is not something that you do, right? Which is why you've read a couple articles that you didn't think were all that cool, but were really about dismissing the appropriations chair because he won't back leadership sponsored bills, which is a real dynamic.
A major power. Exactly. Smackdown.
And Zeldin has already, you know, paid costs for defying the leadership, and Ryan canceled that fundraiser with him, which was just a crazy move, I thought. It didn't make any sense to me, but he did.
Well, it also doesn't make sense to me to get rid of the appropriations chair, right? Hey, we're going to bring a bill that totally screws your constituents. All right, why don't you go ahead and vote for that? And he's like, no, I'm all right. And then they go and punish him for it. Right. Don't put him in that position. If you do put him in that position, understand why he can't vote for it, because he's raising taxes on the constituents, which he probably already agreed not to do at some point in his career with, like, Mr. Norquist and a few others, right?
very explicit. There's a sign.
Right. There's like literally a petition.
There's a paper trail.
that's a good segue for us to the spending bills. Whew. Josh, you want to give us the update on where we stand on the spending bills?
So the spending bills are being discussed, right, as they have been discussed. And we know that they will continue to be discussed. The point is that they want to make you believe that we're going to get out of here by December 22nd.
Right now there's a two-week CR.
There's a two-week CR that was passed a week ago that takes us to December 22nd. And then at that point in time,
continuing resolution continuing funding at current levels, basically because they couldn't get an agreement.
Right. You know? So we have a CR that goes to, is 22nd or 23rd?
22nd.
22nd. And then at that point in time, we're supposed to have a wrapped up spending bill. Well, they're not going to have a wrapped up spending bill because the spending bill has a whole bunch of stuff attached to it, like CHIP and DACA at the current moment and a few other things that are being discussed as we float that. So what they're now discussing is that they want to pass a continuing resolution for 11 of the appropriations bills, all domestic spending, and a full spending bill for defense at $640 billion for defense, which is one, well below the authorization, and two, not possible. Right? It's like, this is an idea that was that's been spawned by the House Freedom Caucus and Republican Study Committee. I believe had a heavy hand in this sort of tact. This is dead on arrival in the Senate.
It's the no go.
And Schumer came out and said so. Like, if you vote for this, you're gonna vote for a Republican government shutdown, right? And so it's gonna be very, very interesting to see how you get off this ledge, because they're on it and they're in a weird spot, and they no way, shape, or form are gonna get what they're asking for right now.
Right? And everyone kind of agrees that the current spending caps on both the defense and non-defense side are going to have to be raised. Under the Budget Control Act right now, the caps are $549 on the defense side and $515 on the discretionary side. And everyone agrees the caps are going to be raised. The number that was thrown around a couple weeks ago was raise them over 2 years by $182 billion, which is a huge number.
Right.
That would undo all the cuts that remain from the supercommittee, if you remember that term, not fulfilling its mission back in the supercommittee days, and put us back at the original BCA cap levels. But now that deal looks like it's out the window, and the latest deal looks like you're going to get even more raises, something like $216 billion over 2 years, which is just, I don't think we can describe how huge a number that is.
It's a very large number, and when you marry it with the, sorry to bring us back to taxes, but very, very quickly, it's going to... It's going to blow a nice big hole in the deficit. So this is going to be an interesting combination.
And that 216 comes from the original raising of the defense side by $54 billion over 2 years, is 108. And it's the Democrats arguing, and perhaps successfully arguing this time, for parity with the non-defense side, which would be a large victory for them. But they seem to have the leverage here. There doesn't seem to be much appetite on the Republican side to shut down the government. And they don't have the votes in the House to do this by themselves.
And what's astonishing about this? And this is astonishing, right? When you're talking, when anytime you're talking about $216 billion over the caps, right? That's just bonkers. A lot of dollars. I mean, just to give you some perspective, the last we've done this before, right? We played this exact game
every 2 years.
Twice before. We did it in 2013. We did it in 2015. Every 2 years, they come up with a 2-year agreement to raise the BCA caps, right? And back then, they raised it 30, which was split unevenly. And then the next year, they had it, I believe, 32 over the cap or something like that. Like, and then it would be 30 or 34. It was not $54 billion above the cap.
Big fights over, you know, relatively smaller amounts of money.
Exactly.
Between factions of the Republican Party.
Exactly.
And
it's interesting because Democrats do have the leverage, and this has happened over and over again. And what Democrats have essentially done in the past is say, like, all right, well, since you guys don't have the votes to pass this thing.
Why don't they have the votes, Josh? Why don't you step back and explain what's going on in the House here?
So the House Freedom Caucus and several more than that, many, many more House Republicans will simply not vote for increased spending, or at least have not been able to vote for increased spending on appropriations. They haven't been able to vote for things like the debt ceiling. They haven't been able to do fiscal matters for the most part in the House of Representatives in particular. And so what's been happening is that Republican leaders like John Boehner and Paul Ryan have had to turn to Democrats and say, like, hey, can you bail me out and give me some votes in order to pass this? And in exchange for that, it has come with some Democratic demands met. In 2013, they had a bunch of policy writers that they wanted to get in. That was stripped out, and they came up to an agreement. 2015, the same thing. They had a long list of policy writers, stuff that had to do with Homeland Security spending, immigration changes that were done under Obama. All of those were tossed out as well. But this year, it seems like Democrats are willing to forego some of the concessions on, like, the Dreamers Act, right, on immigration, and they're still killing things like the border wall, but they want the caps raised even more, right? Yep. So as a minority party, they have even more leverage than they usually do on this type of thing. And it's ironic because the people in the House, the groups in the House that really want to cut spending, are so against it that they're unwilling to vote for things that moderately meet their demands. And so instead what happens is that you've given all the leverage to Democrats and they raise the spending way more than you would ever, ever, ever anticipate. So by opposing even like stuff that would moderately increase spending, what these Republicans, these very conservative Republicans in the House are doing is like doubling or tripling the amount of spending that's actually being put
into
law.
And this is a strategic choice for them because they'd rather vote no on that package
and have a pure position
than yes on a smaller package. So it's not that it's irrational. It's just that their rational incentives are very strange given the outcomes.
Well, it's about positioning. It's not about outcomes.
Yeah. And it completely undermines their supposed goal, right? Yeah.
And frankly, I do think that we're going to see people finally write sequestration out of existence. I mean, especially since the deficits start coming from the tax bill.
I think the sequestration that does exist on the mandatory side isn't going anywhere.
No, it's going to be extended again.
In this 2-year deal, it wouldn't shock me if the mandatory.
You got to talk about what the mandatory sequestration is.
So under the Budget Control Act, there's sequestration. If the discretionary spending caps are broken by Congress, then the executive branch has to automatically do across-the-board cuts. But that's also true for a set of mandatory programs with some exceptions. Medicare has a cap of 2% that it can be cut.
That's right.
But under the super committee's failure, those sequestrations on these mandatory programs, which are programs, entitlement programs, things that are required by law people to receive, those sequestrations have been in place. And these are things like farm subsidies and other stuff like that that isn't discretionarily handed out year in year, but it's just put into law. And sequestration has been in place on them for a whole host of stuff in the Farm Bill for years now and keeps getting extending out in each of these Budget Control Act deals. And I don't think that's going away anytime soon. I think one other point I want to make about the whole Spain deal is that, you know, the person getting rolled here is the president.
Mm-hmm.
His budget was ridiculous, first of all.
It's never taken seriously.
It's non-defense side. Was it like the 470s or something crazy like that?
Right.
Well, you know,
which is what the Hill appropriators always say. We use them as a doorstop, but this time they really did.
Well, the funny thing is it's not totally out of line, right? So if this comes up and we're going to do $54 billion above the cap, right? Which is $549 billion under sequestration level, right? Which is actually a $2 billion cut from last year for defense spending. If we add $54 billion to that, it's 603, which is actually the president's number.
On the defense side.
It's also Democrats' number.
It's on the non-defense side where the president is just getting...
Just totally rolled.
Yeah.
Just totally another roll. But the irony here is that Republicans on the Hill don't want 603. They'd prefer 640, right? Or more, right?
Or significantly more.
So this is meeting none of the demands in which the majority party gets.
And they can stop some of that in OCO, too, because the Overseas and Continuing Operations funding is exempt from this stuff.
They're going to have to change that because the budget, right, has this provision that says you can strike all OCO. We're getting super 302-y anyway.
Josh and I were talking earlier about one way the administration also looks like it's going to get rolled terribly is that the supplemental funding for disaster relief in Texas and Florida and Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, the administration put in a new request for $44 billion.
With offsets.
And they wanted that offset, so spending cuts to match that.
Right.
And Josh told me earlier today that it looks like the congressional number is going to be $70 to $80 billion without offsets.
Right.
So the administration and Congress were only about $80 billion apart on the disaster funding. And I can tell you, I will bet you my dollars or donuts that Congress wins on that one.
Right. Well, I mean, Congress just won big this week, right? They passed the National Defense Authorization Act.
Sure.
And that was signed by the president. And the National Defense Authorization Act does some of the following things. It prohibits military cooperation with Russia. It limits them diplomatically with Russia.
Yeah.
It limits the ability to recognize Crimea.
Yeah.
And then further, if the White House does not give Congress a cybersecurity report, it defunds the White House Communications Agency.
Aren't those the greatest threats?
And then
zeroing out the White House is so great.
The president signed it, right? And so he's like, and I have some signing instructions. Like, pretty sure you're not going to get around that one. It's just an amazing.
Force him to shine.
But let's get back to the spending stuff for a second. Like, that's not it, right? We're not even capturing, after all of that, we're not capturing everything because we still have this PAYGO waiver that we'll have to do if the tax bill goes through.
See, I don't see that as a big deal.
Well, it may not be, but we're talking about deficits now in FY 2018 that are going to be like $700 billion, right?
So what's PAYGO?
Yeah.
Oh, God, PAYGO.
I can do it if you want.
All right, go for it.
So there's a law in the books called PAYGO, and that requires that new spending in Congress new mandatory spending or new reductions in revenues be offset. And if they're not offset, then the at the end of the session, Congress, the OMB has to do across the board cuts.
Right. PAYGO stands for pay as you
pay
go.
As you go. Right. Right.
The basic idea. So you're supposed to fund programs that you put in place.
Anytime you put a new program in place, new spending, you need to find an offset. Anytime you cut revenue, you need to find cuts to make up for that.
They've got a long scorecard with all of these things.
Yep. Yes, and at the end of the session, OMB adds up the scorecard, and if PAYGO, if you haven't paid as you go, then they cut stuff for you. It's just a law. Congress could repeal it. But what Congress has tend to do when they want to pass a major thing is they've waived PAYGO. This is a spot you see a lot of liberals on the internet want the Democrats to put their foot down and say, nope, we're not waiving PAYGO. If you want to do this tax bill, you're going to eat $100 billion in mandatory spending cuts automatically from the
executive. Except that would be like $100 billion out of things like Medicare.
Yeah, the Democrats like. It's just not feasible. I just can't see it happening. But, no. You know, it is kind of the problem with PAYGO-style systems is that, you know, they work until you decide they shouldn't work. And so what PAYGO does is it stops people from getting little programs in because the leader can just say, well, PAYGO. And then when they want to do something big, and they get the collective action to do it, they just waive PAYGO. So I expect PAYGO will be waived without much of a fuss from the Democrats. I've been wrong a couple times before in the Senate, but that's what I expect.
we've seen kind of different versions of PAYGO.
Well, I mean, if they
over
do have
time,
to,
I mean, and there have been earlier ones that have been more effective. You know, frankly, Poppy Bush gets credit for the one in the 1990 bill really being effective over time. The recent one, not so much.
We're at the 35-minute mark, and no one in the history of the world has listened to a political podcast past 38 minutes. So we better wrap it up.
Does anyone except for this one.
We can do quick hits. Josh, you have a quick 1-minute hit you want to do on any topic?
No,
Laura.
I do think that, you know, Schatzsnyder said that, you know, policy creates politics. I think there are a lot of kind of major policy changes that are coming up that will have implications for politics in the way that often the people who are the champions of them are not fully thinking through. Yeah. And maybe that's a topic for another time. My other comment is Roll Tide.
Yes. my final pitch is that what you see from Doug Jones is remarkable in Alabama. But this fits into a longer pattern in the last 10 years of Republican primary results hurting their general election chances. You saw this in Delaware when Mike Castle was beat by Christine O'Donnell in 2010. He would have easily sailed to that seat. Same thing in Indiana when Richard Murdoch beat Dick Lugar. Lugar would still be in that seat if he wasn't there. You saw it also with Todd Akin in Missouri and Sharon Angle in Nevada. They have the Nevada seat now, but there's no doubt in my mind that with the Delaware seat and the Indiana seat and now the Alabama seat, Republicans could easily have a 54-46 edge in the Senate, and none of these things we'd be talking about would matter. So one big thing to understand about Alabama is that this continues a trend of the Republican primary extremism hurting the GOP strength in Congress.
Right. All right, well, that's us for Two Beers In. Hope you enjoyed the episode. We will be back at some point in the near future. We don't know when that'll be, but we know it'll be weird in between now and then. So we'll see you then.
See you then.